Thank you for joining me for another episode of Law and Religion Down Under, a podcast devoted to covering the interactions of law and religion in the South Pacific. Each episode features a guest from across the range of religious and political ideologies. I'm your host, Jeremy Patrick. Our topic for today is religious freedom in Australia, and more specifically, how the political discourse around it has changed significantly in recent years. My guest is Dr. Eleni Poulos, an academic from the Macquarie School of Social Sciences and the author of several recent papers on the topic. Dr. Poulos, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, it's good to be with you, Jeremy.
So much of your recent work has discussed the changing nature of the discourse of religious freedom, which is something I had definitely noticed, but I wasn't able to really articulate it or study it definitely to the degree that you have. In one of your papers, you identify three phases of religious discourse stretching back to the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And so I thought maybe as sort of baseline, we could start with that early phase, which I think you identify as from around the mid-1980s to the early 2000s. What was the religious discourse like, or religious freedom discourse like in Australia at that time?
Yeah, so it was 1984 when the first public report into religious freedom was released. And up until then, really no political or governmental institutions were talking about it very much. So this report was issued by the New South Wales Anti-Discrimination Board, and it was quite a massive report, and it was the first study really of religious freedom in Australia, and it came out of a context where there were increasing numbers of reports from people who'd moved to Australia from other countries and who who were Muslims or Hindus, Jewish people, and they were reporting increasing rises of discrimination against them, particularly recently arrived Muslim people. So the report was largely a response to that. It was a time when Australia's multiculturalism was growing, when our society was becoming more diverse, that in including religious diversity, and so there were incidences of religious discrimination that came to the attention of the New South Wales Anti-Discrimination Board, and they did this report, and so that kind of concern around discrimination faced by people from religions that other than Christian was the major concern that kind of came through in the discourse about religious freedom from 1984 on into the early 2000s.
And one of the descriptors you use sort of for the mainstream Christian discourse during that time was ontological security. So a feeling of, I guess, being part of the majority and being comfortable, so not being afraid of discrimination or suppression of religious freedom, and that sort of affected maybe what political pressures were or weren't put on for legal reform. Would that be right?
Yes, that's right. So, I think all of the church responses, for example, to that 1984 report were pretty harsh. They didn't like the suggestion that religious freedom needed to be articulated as a grounds for anti-discrimination protections. They felt that everything was just fine, and that's that sense of ontological security that they had because of Australians' kind of Christianized culture, even though we're a secular state, Christian values, that this idea of some kind of Christian foundation for Australia since invasion was well entrenched in the community, and any attempt to shift that balance to religious minorities was resisted by the churches during those years.
I think that
was seen to be a threat to them for all sorts of reasons, including their concern with litigation against them for for example, for speaking about the truth of Christianity, against what might be the truth of other religions, for any attempts to proselytize, that kind of stuff. So they were concerned about how they would be open to litigation, based on any apparent discrimination that they might be seen to be involved in. So, yeah.
I think that also maybe that time frame is when many Christians were opposed to the constitutional referenda to extend the Bill of Rights and the federal guarantee of religious freedom to the states, and there was opposition to that. I think out of concern that it would affect religious schools, but it, I guess in a way it's, there's a sort of irony of not supporting religious freedom protections during that time period. And then you talk about a second phase as a balancing rights type of discourse from around 2011 to 2014. So what was the rhetoric like at that point?
It came mostly from the human rights institutions and policymakers who, in response to concerns about the growing protection for LGBTIQ rights in particular in law, and so this discourse about, oh, we need to balance rights, and the first kind of use of that language of balancing rights that I could find actually dated back to 1984, where the Anglican Church in Sydney in particular was making a claim that rights were balanced, as it was, and that balancing rights discourse was used by the churches a lot during that time in response to, for example, draft pieces of legislation that would improve the protection of LGBTIQ people from discrimination, and churches and Christian right groups and Christian lobby groups, like Christian schools groups in particular as well, were talking about how any proposals to improve protection for people from minority religions and to improve protection for the gay community, would be unbalancing appropriately balanced rights. So they were concerned that the balance was being shifted away from religious freedom and to minority groups.
Okay. And then that evolves into what you call the freedom of belief discourse from around 2015 to 2019. And that period, of course, includes the same-sex marriage plebiscite and all of the religious freedom discourse around that.
So that's the time when the language of religion as belief became the dominant discourse in Australian conversations about religious freedom, and it was in response to marriage equality. The issue for the Christian right in Australia, and for many, but not all churches, and for many of the and pretty much all the Christian lobby groups, was around that their beliefs about marriage were being threatened, and therefore their religion was being threatened. And this the conceptualization of religion that came out during that period was that religion was identified as basically a bundle of beliefs, and very particular beliefs at that, often focused on marriage and family and sexuality and sexual diversity. So that threat to what we believe became prominent in the discourse, and was extended by the addition of freedom of speech and freedom of conscience, as they kind of got intertwined in the discourse. So it was like a threefold cord, if you like, and it also allowed allowed the religious advocates to bring in the fact that not only religious people believed in heterosexual marriage only, many non-religious people had that belief as well. So be belief became kind of foundational to the way not only that religious freedom was talked about, that's about protecting my right to have and speak and practice my beliefs, but also became central to how religion became portrayed in the public conversation.
And we also see that transformation, I guess specifically with Christianity, from seeing itself as a majority religion to a minority religion. And that, I think you used the phrase existential threat, or that feeling of being victims in a larger society that doesn't properly take into account religious beliefs.
Yes, that's right. And there was a feeling threat, there was a sense of threat to their identity, to that came from sexual equality and from secularism. And so there was a there were a lot of speeches and opinion pieces written and articles in newspapers that talked about aggressive secularism and how aggressive secularism was finding its face in the movement for LGBTI rights and minority religious rights. But that focus on minority religious rights kind of disappeared during the marriage equality debates because with a focus on religion as belief, the Christian right was very effective actually at pulling together the kind of the conservative streams and conservative religious leaders from other traditions. So that got pulled into advocacy against marriage equality based on this same idea that that our religious beliefs are being threatened.
I've noticed, and I guess I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that, the past several years in Australia, the discourse around religious freedom is almost always sort of in opposition to equality claims from LGBTIQ plus individuals or groups. In contrast to the United States, for example, where often abortion is the defining topic. Australia, it's been marriage equality originally, and now moving into transgender rights, or opposition to transgender rights by some religious groups. So is that something you've noticed, or is am I just looking in the wrong places?
No, it's I've noticed it. I've noticed it too. So, I mean, and it actually, I think, and I mentioned this earlier, it came from the balancing rights discourse, which entrenched in the public conversation, this idea that religious freedom and equality rights were, inherently opposed to each other. So you couldn't protect religious freedom if you were granting equality rights to minority groups in society. And I think that was an unintended consequence that emerged out of a whole lot of government and parliamentary review reports into religious freedom and a whole lot of human rights institutions, consultation reports on, for example, LGBTIQ rights. So that balancing rights idea was entrenched, and the policymakers continue to use that discourse. It's very interesting, balancing rights. Even though it has entrenched that opposition, that's kind of locked themselves into that, very hard to break out and then begin to have a conversation about how we can protect religious freedom and we can also protect the rights of minority groups in society. So while policymakers continue to talk about balancing rights, a lot of conservative Christian right activists for religious freedom have well and truly continued on with the freedom of belief discourse. And we saw that most potently expressed in Scott Morrison's Religious Discrimination Bill, where one of the most divisive sections in that bill was around statements of belief. There was a whole section in that draft bill about the protection of statements of belief, and the bar for what was regarded as a statement of belief was set very low.
And I liked one of the passages in your papers. You talk about how a discussion of religious discrimination sort of turned from discrimination against religious people to whether or not discrimination by religious people, should be legally enshrined. And that's a really interesting development there that that one might not expect. So would you say we're still in this third phase, the freedom of belief phase, or do you think after the defeat of the Morrison bill, we've moved into a different phase, or maybe it's too early to tell.
Yeah, no, look, I actually think we're still there. I think that this notion of belief has become so powerful that it's become almost, and I've written about this, sacralized in the public discourse. It is both, it's both uniquely solid, like it's unchallengeable. It's not open to interrogation. Like a belief is a belief. And we have to do everything we can to protect people's beliefs. But it's also become uniquely vulnerable. So, vulnerable to threats from the accrual of rights, by minority groups. So that kind of embeddedness of belief as something that needs to be understood as sacred by society at large, I think is still, it's just become stronger, actually. And the most recent debates around the Australian Law Reforms Commission's report into how to better protect LGBTIQ plus teachers and students in schools, I think, would demonstrate that. And just to go back to this idea of existential stress and meaning vertigo, that kind of insecurity that leads to very heavy duty responses. I mean, the responses from the Christian schools lobby was quite hysterical, actually. It was like, our whole religion would collapse if we were not able to discriminate against people in our government-funded schools. So, it was. I think we're still there. I think we're going to be there for a long time until we can find a way to break through this constructed impasse between religious freedom and minority rights.
I guess that leads into my next question. We've talked about sort of the changing phases of discourse. What do you think are the causes of the change? Is it because of a strategic legal political decision by, I think you used the phrase, the religious freedom lobby, or is it, a media construct, or is it just changing social attitudes? What would you attribute the changes to?
I think they're largely but not wholly strategic, and you can see that in the language that conservative Christian leaders and lobby groups have used over time. How, as we spoke about earlier, in those early years, they were against the protection of religious freedom in law, and now they are advocating for religious freedom as a to be added as a positive protection in law. During that middle phase, from a kind of like 2011 to 2015, there was a lot of talk from religious freedom advocates about a hierarchy of rights and how religious freedom was at the top of that hierarchy. It was like the most fundamental right, and therefore the balance needed to be always in favor of that absolute top of the hierarchy of rights, religious freedom. I'm not sure I've answered your question there, but
No, you
gone
have.
off a
And
bit on
I
a
guess
tangent.
it'd be interesting to see if some of the influences on, if it is a strategic sort of decision, if it is influenced by developments in other countries, or if it is a solely Australian sort of genesis about the best way to achieve concrete political aims, that'd be
Well,
interesting.
I mean, the work that I did with Angus MacLean, Louise Richardson's self, looked at particular on the US discourse of religious freedom, and we tracked how that discourse began appearing in Australia. So, there is a lot of influence around religious freedom advocates in the language that they use, and I think I think that's more evidence of the strategic shifts that people make in order to gain dominance in the public discourse. Because one of the ways that you achieve your policy outcomes that you're successful with your policy agenda is actually to change the discourse. And that's one of my key interest in studying the way that we talk about religion in the public space, and that intersection of religion and politics, is to look at how people use religious discourse and how people with religious agendas use political discourse to achieve their aims. So, I think there's a lot about that speaks to the strategic nature of the change. But at the same time, it's also, as we've already talked about, it's also quite a personal response to change that's happening around us. The increasing insecurity that people feel when moral codes, for example, that they believe have underpinned the foundations of society, get challenged by the moral codes of minority groups. So, and then the existential stress that comes from that, and you put that in together with wanting to influence the development of policy reform and law reform, it gets to be pretty potent. And religious freedom went from, being a really marginal niche issue in the 1980s to becoming, a massive public debate in 2017, and still, very heated whenever it comes up in the public space.
Well, and you make an interesting point too about the difference between perceived threat versus actual threat, and that often it's hard to find sort of concrete examples of religious freedom being suppressed legally in Australia. I know some people point to Israel Folau, and there's different maybe isolated examples of what could arguably be suppression, but it's not China. There's not widespread closure of churches or control of bishops or something like that. So that is interesting. I'd also be curious to see or hear from you. Do you think other minority, non-Christian minority religions, do they generally follow the discourse of the Christian right or religious freedom lobby, or do they, from what we can see, have a different type of discourse?
I think the discourse that I've noted from a lot of Australian Muslim groups and Jewish groups has a strong focus on the practice of the freedom to practice their religion, and things like attacks on their religious buildings and institutions. Not so much a focus on the freedom to believe, but rather the freedom to be religious people without facing persecution. So it's quite different kind of language, but where they come together is on very particular issues where the traditional religious doctrine matches up. So marriage equality was one of those issues. But you know, I mean, what you mentioned was right. Even the Ruddock report found very little evidence that Christians in Australia were systemically, you know, being persecuted in or discriminated against in any way. You know, having debates that you know, can often become toxic is not the same as being discriminated against. So, you know, we need to understand the difference between those two things, I think. And you know, being challenged for ideas that you hold, you know, could be seen as a good conversation to have, one that leads both parties of the conversation to understand things in a new way. So that's you know, that's what I hope might happen when we get past this religious freedom automatically means that you can't support other people, which is, you know, how the debate has been framed. But just to kind of go back to minority religious groups in Australia and their persecution, one of the outcomes of this, the focus on Christianity and discrimination in the religious freedom debate, has been that the concerns, probably until recently and until the what we're seeing as outcomes of the invasion of Gaza, until recently has really dampened and silenced the voices of religious leaders from other religious communities who have genuine concerns about the safety of their people.
That's a good point, an important point. You've been very generous with your time, so I'll just ask one last question. Do you see gleanings in the future of a new discourse evolving after the defeat of the Morrison Religious Discrimination Bill? Or do you think, as far as you can tell, that the current phase is likely what we'll see continuing into the rest of the 2020s?
I think it will. I think freedom, the freedom of belief discourse, I think it's very strongly embedded in the public conversation about religious freedom. And unless the Law Reform Commission can support the federal government to find a way through that discourse, I think it's going to continue to be the dominant way that we talk about religious freedom in this country, and also by extension, the dominant way that we understand religion as being mostly about belief and little about other things to do with, you know, culture and practice and, you know, rites of life and death and all of those sorts of things. So it's going to be an interesting couple of years, I think, to see whether we actually can get a religious discrimination bill up. I think the conversation is so divisive and heated and polarized that it's a very difficult ask.
I think you're right. And I think we're in a little bit of a lull right now that, you know, newspaper headlines aren't about religious freedom or discrimination particularly. But that of course can change as issues arise in the near future. But thank you very much for coming on the show and sharing your scholarship and ideas with me. I've learned a lot and I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for the invitation. I hope it has been helpful. I hope it's helpful for your listeners too.
I'm sure it will be. Listeners, that is it for this episode of Law and Religion Down Under. I'll place links to some of the scholarship we discussed in the show notes, and I'll be back in 2 months with another episode. Thanks for listening.